She's one of the best investigators I have.
But?
She's different.
In what way?
In every way.
Something wrong with the report?
Anything you chose not to disclose?
He's clean, in my opinion. He's honest.
Our credibility isn't dead yet.
Mine is.
He's had a long-standing sexual relationship with his co-editor of the magazine. Sometimes he pleasures her. Not often enough, in my opinion.
No, you're right not to include that.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best in popular culture. The show is brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. Our topic this week is Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And our guest is James Hickson, a graduate from the University of South Carolina with a degree in history. James struggles against the bonds of cubicle temp purgatory as the founder, editor-in-chief, and main writer for Domino Comics. Domino Comics is aimed at bringing a more classical form of comic storytelling into the digital age with a modern bent for all ages. Welcome aboard the White Rocket Show, James. It's great to have you.
Pleasure to be here, Van.
All right. And it's good to finally get to talk to you because I've known you for a while here and there on the internet, but it's cool to have you on for a conversation about what I think is a really interesting topic this week, the famous Swedish crime mystery thriller novels and the films that were made from them both in Sweden and in the U.S. that comprise, it's generally called, it's, the official name is the Millennium Trilogy, named after the magazine in it. But I've got to tell you, the original Swedish titles for the books were, okay, the first one famously was Men Who Hate Women.
Yes.
The original Swedish title of the second one is not much different, The Girl Who Played with Fire. And the original Swedish title, this is my favorite, by the way.
Yes, this was great.
Although I have to say that Men Who Hate Women probably wouldn't have ever been a bestseller, and I can understand why they might have rejected it originally, and he did get turned down a lot. And, of course, the original Swedish title for the third one, the Hornet's Nest one, is The Air Castle That Blew Up.
Yes, that has to be. I mean, I've looked at the Swedish spelling, and it looks like it's just two words. So I imagine there must be some common phrase in Swedish for air castle
that blew up. I love the idea that, you know, like two old Swedish men are talking about. Yeah, did you see the Super Bowl this week? Oh, that air castle blew up. It's just like, you know. Just like some common phrase that they use. Yeah. Oh, I hate when the air castle blows up, man. That's terrible.
Oh, goodness.
Well,
there are certain cultural differences here that we'll probably get into later in the podcast, which make this series very distinctly Swedish.
Yes.
And I think the first place we really see that is in the first book, where the main character, Michael Blomqvist, who is a very thinly veiled Stieg Larsson, ends up getting sentenced for libel and sentenced to jail time.
Yeah, you know, there are there's a lot of Stieg Larsson, and I also like the idea that he basically has his main character, who is him, you know, sleep with every woman that comes along, and he's irresistible to women, and
he is a Swedish liberal James Bond.
Yeah. and it's fitting that they had Daniel Craig, I guess, play him in the American version of the movie then.
Yes, and we'll get that later, but he's a very different character, and Daniel Craig does it wonderfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's probably a good thing they changed the names of the books for the English-speaking audience, and it certainly has done pretty well. They also, by the way, I want to mention while I'm thinking about it, they also did an interesting thing with the publication of them, at least here in the United States. And I know that having been to bookstores in Singapore that have British and European as well as American editions of everything, the covers are totally different from most popular books in Europe than they are in America. But in the American versions of these books, they did things with the cover that were pretty innovative. Like they used a lot of fluorescent oranges and greens and yellows, tennis ball, you know, day glow colors.
And yes, I think now everyone's cover is like that.
Right, right. I think they did a good job of making them stand out on the shelf 4 or 5 years ago. But you're right, it's not quite so unique anymore. But for a while there, they were a really eye-catching thing. Okay. So, the books were very eye-catching in the way they were designed. But you're right, I think a lot of other publishers have copied that in the last few years, and it sort of lost its distinctiveness. So. Well, I think that we should probably start with, I think to really understand these books, you have to look at the man behind them. And we're talking about Stieg Larsson. So just a little bit about him real quickly. He was like you said, he was a crusading magazine publisher. He was anti-fascist. And, you know, there's the story that he witnessed a friend named Elizabeth being gang raped when he was a young man. And he couldn't or wouldn't do anything to help. And he felt horribly guilty about it later. Now, later on, that story has been challenged by people who knew him, saying that it maybe was, you know, more of an apocryphal story. He didn't actually do it. But I tend to find that happens a lot with authors that are famous. When they were not famous, they've told these stories that sound good. And when they get famous, they kind of have to explain how they kind of made up these stories. So he's not the first to be in that trap, if that's true. But
however, I would like it to be known by all that it is true that I have been a superhero.
Okay.
I'm not going to back down on this later.
I see. I got you. It took me a second, but I got you. Right. So you're not going to, later on when you're the Stan Lee of Domino and it's huge, you won't have to say, oh, I, you know, that was never true. Right. So, okay. Well, he wrote these books, I think, trying to work through some issues he had, just like he published the magazine, trying to expose fascists and sort of skinheads, neo-Nazis in Sweden, which I didn't realize there were a lot of, but apparently there are. More about that in a minute. And the sad thing is, apparently he just chain smoked like a smokestack, and so he climbed several flights of stairs to deliver the manuscripts for the first three books, and then fell over dead of a heart attack.
Good Lord. That is such a weird way to die. You're delivering these books that you become internationally famous for,
mm-hmm.
and then you die.
Yep. Yep. He died before they ever saw publication. And so that was in 2004. And by 2008, they were pretty much a worldwide phenomenon. He published, his magazine was called Expo, by the way, but the magazine and the books and the movies is Millennium. And oh, there's one other little story, which is that he had basically a common law wife, but they weren't actually married, his longtime partner, Eva Gabrielsen. And he never married her, the story goes, because he was trying to protect her from the crazy, you know, fascists, the skinheads and all. And when you get married in Sweden, they publish your name and address in the paper and stuff. And so because they never actually got married, she got shut out of the rights to the property, to the books and the movies. So the family that he was sort of estranged from has all the rights and all the money. And his basically wife doesn't get any of it. But the one thing that she does have is what? Have you heard this?
Yes, the fourth book, the unfinished fourth manuscript.
Mm-hmm. So we will see if anything ever comes of that. We may never see it because of the legal wrangling between her and the family. That would be kind of a shame, you know. But
which is upsetting because there are so many dangling plot points from both the books and the movies that are unanswered, especially about Lisbeth's life.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, Larsson originally planned this to be a 10-part book series.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I had not realized that until looking stuff up for this show. But yeah, 10 book. And apparently there are maybe, this is unconfirmed, bits and pieces of the other books, you know, out there. Just little bits and pieces, notes and outlines. So You know, this is the same sort of thing that I was talking about with Rick Lai last week about James Clavell. In both cases, you know, have an author who dies before a series is done. And I'm looking at you, George R. R. Martin. but you, and the question that Rick and I discussed a little bit, and that John Ringer and I discussed about George R. R. Martin, this is the third week that this topic has come up, which is, would you want another author to pick it up? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would like to see the fourth book, but unless he has very detailed notes for the next 10, I don't know. And really, you have to wonder who can take it on, because it comes from a very interesting perspective, especially in the character of Michael,
yeah.
Bloomquist. It is very much Larson himself, and you know, a sensationalized, romanticized version of Larson.
Right.
And, I mean, I would love to see the fourth book, but I don't know if they could actually continue it on to a 10-book series. And I don't think, even if they ever do, that they'll be as well regarded as the original trilogy. Because it's the same thing with, say, like, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books that were written after Douglas Adams died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're interesting, they're great, but there's always going to be this part of the fandom or readership that says this doesn't count.
Yeah, there have been a number of books like that have come later. There was a Godfather book, there was a Gone with the Wind book. You know, as a Roger Zelazny fan, the you know, Zelazny never wanted his Amber books to have any more books written, and but his ex-wife kind of had control of it somehow after he died, and so they first looked to the two authors that would make the most sense to continue that series, Stephen Bruce and Neil Gaiman, but they both respected Zelazny enough to say no. And so Gregory Betancourt came in and wrote a trilogy of prequels. And, you know, they're, you can tell he's trying to copy Zelazny rather than being Zelazny caliber of a writer. So you could see somebody maybe copying this style, but I don't know that it would have the same depth or the same flavor to it, just because, like you say, he's kind of coming from his own perspective, his own unique situation, I think, and it would be hard to kind of duplicate that for anybody else.
Have you noticed that so many of these fan favorite series, there's some kind of health issue with the writer? Either they're overweight, they have Alzheimer's, they chain smoke.
Yeah.
I know from personal experience that writing does not necessarily lend itself to physical fitness and trips to the gym.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it just seems
my physical fitness has deteriorated every year that I've been writing. So I can totally agree with that.
And we won't even get started on mine.
Yeah, I think that my friend John Ringer, that did the big George R. R. Martin fan, the Game of Thrones fan, he's about ready to drive down to George's house and like be his personal trainer or something, because we're concerned that we won't get any more of those books before he dies. So we got to wrap that story up. But well, here's some interesting statistics about the Millennium Trilogy. The trilogy itself has sold going on 100 million copies. Now, I don't think it's quite 100 million, but the last statistics I saw were a year or two old, and it was getting up there. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo became the first million-selling novel on Kindle. That's interesting, I think.
Yes.
And the Hornet's Nest book was the best-selling book in the United States in 2010. And I have a hardback copy of it, so I contributed to that because I wanted to know the ending. You know, people had probably for three or four years been reading them, and when that one came out in 2010, everybody ran out and bought it all at once and put it up on the bestseller list. And in 2008, Larson was the second best-selling author in the world, only behind the Kite Runner dude Khaled Hosseini. So I never would have guessed that. So.
Yeah,
so
that's interesting.
Yeah, so very popular books. I actually, when I was reading them, I actually got the Audible audio versions as well, so that I could read the book, and then like if I was in the shower or in the car, I could just pick right up where I was reading it and listen, and mm-hmm. and blow through it a lot faster, because they are pretty hefty. They're not super long, but they're dense, you know.
Especially the second and third book, they're much more procedural. Yeah. And you definitely get the sense, I think we'll talk about this later, that the second and third book were written far after the first book. Because the first book is very much a self-contained, very concise and very quick tale. The second and third book are really just one book.
Right.
I mean, you have the murder and then you have the trial.
But then you have all that stuff with the government, and there's just so many characters. You're right. You have the whole police procedural on the one hand. Then you got Blomqvist and you got Elizabeth running around doing stuff separately. And then you've got the magazine people. And then you've got the people from Elizabeth's background, her past. And there's just so many characters and so many things. And you need to know everything from the first book, and then all this new stuff comes in, right? So there's like five or six discrete groups of characters in the second and third book that you have to keep track of. It's almost like five different stories running parallel.
Yes.
And it's a very dense read. So, yeah, we were rewatching the second Swedish movie last night, and just, you know, every 5 minutes there's one or two new characters introduced. And we had to kind of
keep... And almost certainly one of them would be a kick-butt woman.
Yeah, and we had to keep stopping going, all right, so this is who now? This is that person, right? Because, yeah, if you wait you go like a year without reading or watching one of these things and go back, wait a minute now, who's this guy? Oh, that's the kickboxer, or that's the secret agent or something. So it's, there's a lot going on there. And I think that's one of the appeals of it. I think that's one of the reasons that people like it so much, like the whole series so much, is that there's just so much going on. You get a huge slice of life, of this story and these characters in these three books. You get a whole lot for your money and for your experience, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. Let's see. First about the books, and then we'll talk a little bit about the movies afterward. And when we talk about the books, we first got to talk about the characters. And I wanted to point out, I think that other than Lisbeth Salander, who is, I think, one of the most fascinating, interesting, and remarkable characters in fiction in many years, I think the most vivid character in the books is probably Sweden itself.
Yes. Yes, because I knew nothing about Sweden before this,
mm-hmm.
except that it was up there somewhere.
Well, I was going to say, I knew the stereotypes, just the basics, right? I knew that it's cold a lot of the time. I knew they had a lot of blonde-headed people. I knew that they liked their sports. You know, there's Swedish tennis players and soccer players and everything, and hockey. But I didn't – and I knew that all of Scandinavia was supposed to be pretty progressive, and that their governments are fairly liberal, bending toward almost socialist, you know, in terms of how they take care of people and everything. And so I just took all that to mean they were probably very progressive and very forward thinking. And one of the things that really shocked me that I learned in these books was the traditional and the very conservative and old fashioned attitudes toward women.
Yes.
Which I guess if you realize these people are descended from Vikings, it kind of makes sense.
Yes. And that's pretty much one of the things that Stieg Larsson is commenting on with his books, and it's something that you almost get the feeling, and I think this is almost certainly true, that Stieg Larsson wrote the books to draw attention to. That's why the title of the first one was Men Who Hate Women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's very interesting that the character who begins as a supporting character kinda in the first book ends up being the main character for the second and third, and really the main character for the whole trilogy. And that's, of course, Lisbeth Salander.
Right.
Who is supposed to be this victim in the eyes of society.
Right. Yeah, she's just a victim at every turn, but yet she's developed skills that make her certainly able to fight back and get the better of people. I mean, I think I don't want us to give away too many really cool things from the books or movies to people that haven't seen them yet. We will talk about them in some depth as we go along here. But I have to say that some of the things that she does to get revenge are very visceral and physical. And some of the things she does are more, shall we say, financial. And as much satisfaction as I got from the visceral, physical revenge, which is, you know, when a character is very sympathetic and then very put upon, and they get physical revenge. You're like, yeah, get them back. But the financial revenge, then you kind of get to live vicariously through the rewards that she gets, right, from her skills as a computer hacker and so forth. So I loved that part where she's enjoying the material benefits.
I think something you just touched on is something that makes these books very unique in modern literature and in the noir genre itself, which these are very much a part of, is they are very much of the modern age. They're very much of the information age. Lisbeth, as you just stated, is a computer hacker, a brilliant one, probably one of the best ones in Sweden, if not the world. And so many times, like, someone makes the case for horror films, well, their cell phones aren't working. Why aren't their cell phones working? That's so stupid. I just called the police. But here, Larson doesn't make excuses saying, oh, this is why the cell phone doesn't work. He just weaves it into the story. And there are allowances made for this Ericsson cell phone or this computer or this MacBook.
Right. Speaking of Sweden, for those that liked these books and these movies and want to kind of experience more of the crime thriller Sweden, apparently there, you know, this has become kind of a subgenre, the Swedish crime novel
That's
series.
So weird.
Yeah, and it's like as if there was like a sudden upsurge in Angolan westerns or something, but there's a Swedish crime thriller genre. And I, you know, the other great writer besides Larson, who only did the three, is Henning Mankell. And I've got to put in a word for his Kurt Wallander series, which we'll be doing. I'm going to do a show on eventually, as soon as I finish reading the books and seeing all the shows and movies. But it takes place in southern Sweden in the region called Skåne, S-K-A-N-E. Mm-hmm. And so with Larson, you get sort of the I guess mostly Stockholm and then, you know, rural areas.
Extreme northern.
Yeah, the rural areas around there. And with Mankell, you get the Wallander books. He's a detective. You get sort of the southern part right across from Denmark and also interact some with Lithuania and Estonia and so forth.
Is that the one that has Kenneth Branagh in the movies?
Yeah, there's some... Yellow Bird does them too. Yellow Bird does the did the Swedish versions of the Millennium movies, and also was partners in doing the American version. But yeah, Christer Henriksson does the Swedish language versions, and they're on Netflix. They're pretty good too. They have a totally different flavor. It's interesting because I think the Kenneth Branagh versions that the BBC has been doing, with by the way, with Loki from the Avengers as the as his assistant.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I keep telling.
Oh,
Kurt,
I have to
turn
check
around
these out now.
Turn around, Kurt. It's Loki. Look out! he's gonna stab you in the back, son of a gun. But the Branagh versions are darker and have more of a like pathos to them because Wallander is kind of a sad character. You know, he doesn't have the exciting life that Michael Blomqvist has. And and on the other hand, the Christer Henriksson, the Swedish versions are a little more police procedural, not so much character things. So, but they both have their they both have their good side to them. So yeah, we'll look
and
at
I
them.
Think that could actually be an argument that you could use for the U.S. version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo versus the Swedish version as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, I think we're talking about it with my my great friend Trey Lawson. I was talking about it with him on Twitter the other night, that the U.S. version is very much more character-driven as opposed to the Swedish adaptation, which is more of the mystery-driven.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, they're sufficient. That's one thing, though. I was glad, though, that they are sufficiently different that it wasn't just a complete, you know, retelling. I mean, it obviously retells the same story, but you get it from a different approach and everything. So, well, a bit more about the books, I guess. Let's see. We've got Mikael Blomqvist, who is just like Larson, a crusading anti-fascist publisher. And, you know, he's in the first book, he gets pulled into this investigation. He's basically just been sent to prison, and so he's kind of lost control of his magazine and has nothing better to do. And this rich man gets him to come and investigate an old murder case or a missing
Heinrich Wenger.
Yeah, the Wengers. And then that causes him to bring Lisbeth Salander in as kind of a research person, and then it really just takes off from there. And so you get this, it's just sort of a very tight mystery case with these two characters as your two protagonists. But all along, Larson drops in hints and clues and pieces of a larger story involving Lisbeth Salander. And so, as you said a while ago, the second and third books are really one big story that kind of goes into that.
Yes.
So, it becomes more, I think it starts out kind of plot and becomes more character as you go. Would you say that's fair?
Yes. I guess we could start out with the first book, which is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, in which Michael has just been accused of libel against a very successful businessman. And he was basically set up by an old college friend who was turned out to be working for the businessman, because Michael is already doing an investigation that was going to be small potatoes. But then the college friend comes by and says, "Hey, I've got this bigger story about this guy if you're interested." And Michael takes the bait, publishes, and then the story just falls apart. And so Michael is sentenced to 3 months in prison, but there is several months wait before they call him to report. So he gets pulled up to northern Sweden by this industrialist, Heinrich Wenger, who wants him to solve the mystery of his missing, suspected murdered niece, Harriet Wenger. And part of it is, which is one of the reasons I found it so amusing that the U.S. version was released on Christmas, is that he suspects members of his own family. The Wenger clan, three of the patriarchs of, are former Nazis, as being one of the people that killed Harriet. And what substantiates this is that it's basically a locked room mystery, except with an island.
Yeah, with an island. That's right. That's good.
Because there's an explosion on the bridge that leads to the island where the family owns and where they have all their homes. And it seals the island off from the rest of Sweden for a day. And at the end of that day, no one can find Harriet. And Heinrich believes, because of really what sinister and horrible people his family's made up of, that one of them has killed Harriet, and he's been investigating it for 40 years because these 40 years he's being packages on his birthday, flowers, pressed flowers, just like the ones that Harriet used to give him. So he thinks it's a killer taunting him. And so finally he gets fed up and brings in Michael Blomqvist, who used to stay on the island as a boy. He brings him in to investigate Harriet's disappearance. And that's where Michael comes in. He's kind of in exile from his usual group in Sweden. He's a very influential person in Sweden. He basically is exiled from them because of this trial and goes off to live in a cabin in the woods, basically.
Yeah.
Investigating this 40-year-old crime that everyone thinks is this fool's errand, this old man's obsession. And eventually, Lisbeth Salander, who was hired by the Wengers to investigate Michael before they brought him in, is brought in herself as an assistant.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. She was originally going to investigate Blomqvist. That's right.
And it's really... And this relationship comes up between them because Lisbeth, because of the circumstances of her life, does not trust anybody. She's very much this loner character. She doesn't have friends because she doesn't really believe friendship exists. And the only person she could trust in the world basically is herself and perhaps her old guardian, who at the beginning of the movie has a stroke.
Right.
And as
you find out more and more about Salander, you find more and more that she has reason to feel the way she does. I mean, she's not just mentally. Now, she's declared incompetent earlier before the story starts. I guess in Sweden, that means she has to have a guardian to look out for, handle her business, and it includes handling her money. And so that gets into a whole other deal with her relationship with that character, which is not good. But she handles herself, and that character crops up again later and is involved in the bigger plot. So,
Jorman.
yeah. So, well, and then as you say, in the other two books, it sort of expands out into a story much more about her background. And her family and the people in her background that have connections to, like, I guess, Cold War history and the Swedish government itself, which is why it's called the girl that kicked the hornet's nest, because she stirs things up in a big way with the Swedish government itself, and it starts to get bigger and bigger. But I think you mentioned before that on top of all that is sort of this deal where she's accused of murder, and so she's kind of on the run trying to figure the whole thing out while not getting arrested herself.
Yes, the second book, The Girl Who Played Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, basically, Michael and Lisbeth start a relationship.
Yeah.
It's really hard to define. There's definitely a friendship here, but there's also a sexual element. But because of Lisbeth's attitude towards things, you're not really sure it's a romance,
mm-hmm,
until Lisbeth herself forces herself to admit that she's in love with Blomqvist. But because Blomqvist is very much a liberal Swedish James Bond,
he's a ladies man of Sweden.
He's a ladies man. He just views her as a friend that he has sex with.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is because he's been having sex with his best friend, mm-hmm, who's married for the last 20 years, Erica Berger, mm-hmm, who is also the co-publisher of Millennium Magazine.
Right. Yeah, there's a scene where, like, his mom or his aunt or some older lady asks him, is he going to, you know, why isn't he married? And he says, well, you know, whatever. And she says, well, you have a girlfriend? He says, yeah, I have a girlfriend. He's referring to Erica Berger, who's married, and she says, well, why don't you marry her? And he goes, well, she's already married. And the look on her face is like, oh.
One of his brother-in-law's Italian aunts.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, because his sister is a lawyer. There's just so many characters.
Yes.
But they're all interesting. I mean, yeah, his sister is a lawyer, and she figures more into it as things go along, too, because he's going to need a lawyer, and so will Elizabeth. Okay, and then do you have any other thoughts about the books in general before we do any other analysis on them and move to the movies?
Not really before we get to the movies themselves. I have some thoughts as far as the books compared to the movies.
Okay. Well, yeah, so you do get something of a conclusion because, you know, as you said, the second and third books are kind of one big story. And you do get something of a conclusion. It is satisfying. I mean, you know, we were talking about how there are dangling plot threads at the end of the third one, but if you haven't read them yet, don't let that put you off, because you know the immediate stories you do get a satisfying resolution to. So it's just some of the character stuff and the historical stuff we're still wondering about, and still, you know, there's still things to be told there. But that would have made great additional books, but it's not necessary to enjoy these, I don't think. Would you?
Yeah, it's very much something more of an issue in the books, because of course they were planned to be a 10 book series, mm-hmm, so there are other little plot points that are, of course, supposedly meant to be carried on into future books, but the movies themselves were made after the fact, so they knew that Larson was dead, so they probably weren't going to get any more books anytime soon, so a lot of those points are kind of just cut out, mm-hmm, of the movies themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And that's fine.
And I think the main one of those is the character of Camilla Salander, who is Lisbeth's sister.
Sister, right, that's true.
Twin sister, who is not mentioned a single time in any of the movies, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But in the books themselves, she gets name-checked several times. She's very much fashionable blonde daddy's girl. Mm. And when you consider who Elizabeth's dad is, it makes her a possibly very interesting character for future books, which unfortunately looks like we'll never see.
And she's very different from Elizabeth, basically.
Yes.
Who's very antisocial, short, dark hair, little, almost, you know, I've heard her described as almost autistic or something. I don't know. I mean, I think
Asperger's, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think she has as many problems as people around her seem to think. I think that she just is so disillusioned and so alienated from people that it comes across as a more severe condition than maybe she actually has. And I can't blame her for feeling that way because of everything that's happened to her, you know, so.
Yes, her attitude is very much, screw the world, I'm on my own.
Yeah, and she's able to take, even with a declaration of incompetence where she has to have a guardian to keep her money and just give her an allowance and so forth, even then she's able to use her skills and her abilities to be able to get the better of that situation, although, again, in some cases it doesn't go well, but for everybody concerned, but...
No, there are a lot of times when she bucks the rules of society, and it comes back to bite her when society finds out.
Right. Well, let's sort of segue into the movies then, and we can kind of compare and everything. First, there were the three Swedish. From what I'm understanding, tell me if you have a different version of this that you've seen. They did the first one, The Dragon Tattoo, as a theatrical movie in Sweden, and they plan to do the second and third ones as TV movies. And the first one did so well, just made huge box office in Sweden, that they went ahead and edited the second and third ones down to theatrical releases. And so that's why now there's the three short versions that are like 2 or 2.5 hours, and then there's the three extended versions, which are like a, you know, like the, almost like the Lord of the Rings extended editions where they're like 3 hours long and almost TV miniseries length. Is that how you understand it?
That sounds about right. And I think they were actually released as a TV miniseries in France at the same time as the theatrical versions came out because they were so popular. And I guess just media distribution goes differently in Europe because and I don't think on stateside they would ever do something where you could watch the whole movie and extras for free, or you can go see it in the theater.
Right. Yeah. Well, but there have been things like that in America. Like for example, the original Battlestar Galactica, and I think Buck Rogers TV shows, their pilots were released as theatrical movies before they came on television, or after maybe. So there is some precedent, I guess, for it. Let's see. So the Swedish version has Michael Nyquist, who's kind of a stalwart, rugged schlub in a way of a Swedish actor, kind of playing the very low key Michael Blomqvist role. And they have the wonderful Noomi Rapace as Lisbeth.
Yes.
Now, she, you know her from Prometheus. She was the lead female character in Prometheus. And she was also in the Sherlock Holmes sequel with Downey and Jude Law. She speaks fine English, but it's funny because both of the actresses that have played Salander had issues. Noomi Rapace is a big girl. I mean, not big, but she's not 5 feet nothing and 88 pounds. And so she was kind of miscast, but she does such a great job with it that you kind of, you're willing to overlook the fact that she's, but they're saying this is 5 foot tall, 88 pound girl running around, and they show her and she's like taller than people around her, you know. It's
yes.
But
and she's not fat by any means, but she's more thickly built.
Yeah.
Than you would expect of Lisbeth.
Right. But she does a great job, I think, with it.
Excellent.
She gets the vulnerability and the anger and all that. So
to the point where when they were announcing the American version, that Roger Ebert launched a campaign to have her cast again as Lisbeth Salander because he so much enjoyed her in the original Swedish film.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I was sympathetic to that point of view right up until I saw the American version. The American version, of course, has Daniel Craig, which I had issues with. Let me more about that in a second. But to address your point here, Rooney Mara is the American Lisbeth.
Yes.
And I thought she did at least as good of a job as Noomi Rapace.
Yes, both portrayals are very different, but at the same time, they're both very much Lisbeth Salander.
Yeah.
And that kind of, I think, testifies to the quality of the character Lisbeth.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because it isn't all just Lisbeth's style and Lisbeth's demeanor, but that goes a long way towards it. I think Lisbeth, honestly, is going to go down in history as one of those great literary characters like Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And I think time will tell on this one, but I honestly think these books themselves will go down as classics because they are such a shot in the arm for the genre that they're part of that they do bring it into the modern era. Because I think very much the idea of noir before this was the black and white detective on his desk with a fedora. I think that's popular pop culture perspective of noir. And I think that has changed this, and this will be used as a touch point for future noir taste in popular culture. And I may be alone in this. I don't know if you share this opinion, but I really think this is one of those things that is going to bring noir fiction and detective noir fiction into a more public perspective in this next century.
Yeah, no, I think it's, but like you said, it has several things going for it that help that way. One is that it has so much more depth. You know, these are long books, and it has a lot more depth. It has social issues. It explores a lot of things that this kind of fiction probably really didn't want to get into before. Now, I would almost say there's nothing else like it, except that, as I said, there are the Wallander books, but even there, they're more detective oriented. The main character is a detective and he has his problems. Yeah. But nothing like Lisbeth Salander's problems.
No,
he just has like a pending divorce and maybe some cancer or something, which is terrible until you look at Lisbeth Salander's life and you go, oh, it's nothing, you know? So,
yeah. I think what's a testament to that is when I was reading the books again for this podcast, I thought to myself, you know, if Lisbeth was British, she'd be in a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Well, I said on a previous episode of our show here when this came up briefly, I said that she's almost like a superhero. She has her superhero power. They're almost like superhero movies where she's the character who discovers this mutant power or something, you know?
Yes. She has a photographic memory and she is this amazingly talented hacker. And it definitely goes into a more pulp noir territory with the second and third film and books because they bring in a Bond villain.
That's right.
They bring in a Bond henchman in the form of Niedermeyer.
The blonde giant, right?
The blonde giant who can't feel pain.
That is definitely a Bond henchman, definitely.
And I'm like, good lord, it's Jaws.
All he needed was a volcano base or a giant submarine or something. Yeah. But it doesn't get ridiculous though. That's not, again, I don't want to scare off potential readers. It doesn't. No. It's very plausible. It does not ever get that ridiculous. It gets somewhat like, wow, okay, but it never gets to the point that you just throw the book down, I don't think, and cuss at it, does it? Not to you, did it?
No, and I think part of that is intentional because the improbability of it and the implausibility of it kind of works into the narrative when, like, say, Bloomquist finds this out. No one believes him.
Yeah.
They're like, are you on drugs?
That's true. Yeah.
But, you know, instead of volcano bases, we get farmhouses.
Right, right. Yeah, well, creepy Swedish farmhouses out in the middle of nowhere can be just as intimidating and spooky as a hidden volcano in Japan, I guess, really. Right, so I wanted to say a couple of things about the cast of the U.S. version real quick. I mean, David Fincher directed the movie, and we'll more in a minute about future movies. But he cast Daniel Craig, and that was problematic for me at first, and it's proven to be even more problematic going forward. So, and here's the deal with that. When I heard Daniel Craig was cast, I was like, oh, no, because at first that's
Bond.
Yeah, he's James Bond. He's currently – he's not like a previous James. It's not like they had Sean Connery or something. He is the current James Bond. And the problem I had was I was afraid he would overshadow – the movie. Now, as it turned out, the James Bond movie that came out around the time of that of the Dragon Tattoo U.S. version was more of a flop, and so it really, I think that's probably a good thing in a way, because it didn't overshadow this, and I think he did a good job. I was pleasantly surprised, because he is very low key, and he is kind of battle scarred and rugged looking in the face, like Nyquist and, you know, the Swedish actor was. And so he looks the part and he can act the part. And I was always afraid I was going to think, oh, he's going to take out the whole bad guy group with a couple of karate moves, you know, or pull out an exploding pin or something. But that never bothered me. What was your reaction seeing him in the role?
I actually thought he was the better Blomqvist of the two. Mm. I mean, they're in the Swedish films, and that's something I kind of wanted to talk about. In the Swedish films, Blomqvist gets Watsoned.
Yeah,
he gets Watsoned from his version in the books.
And you mean by that?
I mean by that they downgrade his intelligence and his ability to find things on his own to make Lisbeth sound
more smarter, Sherlockian.
Yes, smarter and more interesting, like they do with Watson and Sherlock Holmes films.
Right.
For instance, there are all kinds of connections that Blomqvist makes on his own in the Harriet Wenger case that in the films he doesn't make until Lisbeth points it out to him. And he is a very capable character in his own right. And he's a lot cooler in his own right than he's made in the movies, really. Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, when he sees Lisbeth's motorcycle, in the movies, he's kind of like, oh, you want to get on a motorcycle? In the books, he's kind of like, awesome, I had a motorcycle when I was a kid. So I think there was an effort to make him, first, more relatable to Swedish audiences and general audiences by making him a little bit more... Miltoast?
I think he's more reactionary, yes, as opposed to proactive in the, you know, he gets to be kind of the audience's extended self reacting to things and going, oh wow, oh hey, look at that, you know. Whereas, yeah, you're right, in the books he's more doing stuff,
and he gets more of his initiative back, I think, in the American film. Mm-hmm. And Daniel Craig, he's not James Bond in this film.
No.
He put on weight for the role. He wears sweaters.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this very interesting. It's because you live in Sweden that you can look really cool while still wearing a sweater underneath your awesome leather jacket.
Yeah, that's right. Well, because it's cold. Well, yeah, and so Daniel Craig kind of worked out, but he's proven to be a two-edged sword because he's just been in a little movie called Skyfall.
Yes.
Which people are about tired of hearing my opinion on, so I won't go there. But it has made well over $1 billion now, by far, and at least in present dollar terms, the most successful Bond movie ever.
It's rescued MGM.
Oh yeah. And it's made more, it's still a few hundred million away from the Avengers, but it's passed both of the recent Batman movies, which is mind blowing to me. But that makes me happy, actually, in a way, because I like James Bond better than Batman. But the point is, you now have to wonder if they can get him back to do the other two movies. And I have heard rumors that not only are they not going to try to get Daniel Craig for the next two movies, assuming that they do them, and everything I've heard is that they're still in the process, but that they may actually just write Blomqvist's character out of this two movies and use some other character in that part.
What?
Yeah, and I know, I can't quite fathom that.
No, because he's Stieg Larsson.
I know.
That's ridiculous.
Everybody I've mentioned this to says, why don't you just recast Blomqvist? And I'm like, well, sure, why not get another actor to come in? And there's plenty of schlubby, you know, world-weary actors out there that could do it.
Get Liam Neeson. That'd be interesting.
He could do it. He might be on a little older, but yeah, I mean, yeah. He would work, though. But yeah, there's plenty of actors that could do it. But yeah, I can't imagine just writing the character out. But I can totally see why they do have a problem.
But I honestly think if they asked Craig, he would go for it.
Well, I'm sure they have.
Well, I don't know. I think they're just scared by the money, maybe.
Well, and I've heard different reports as to whether they're going, you know, what stage the other two. In other words, the first one did not make the money they hoped it would.
No.
And I have to say, it was my favorite movie of 2011. It came out at Christmas. I loved it. I
watched it yesterday, and I was very much surprised on how much I liked it. I think I actually liked it more than the Swedish version, despite the fact I think Rapace was a better Lisbeth. Because, okay, when I first heard they were remaking the film, my first thought was, oh, God, they're going to Americanize
it. I know, everything. Exactly.
I thought, you know, instead of Northern Sweden, this it'd be an island in Maine. And Michael Lundqvist would be a journalist from Boston.
From Rolling Stone or something.
Yes, and because, you know, Maine and Sweden, same place, different accents.
This is true. Yeah, I know. I was very nervous about it because I did dearly love the Swedish versions, and I wasn't really anxious to see what. But I thought David Fincher did a really good job, and he's supposed to be doing the next two. And the screenwriter, Steven Zalian, I believe. So it sounds like that same duo will be coming back for the second and third one. And it sounds also like the studio is pretty, you know, in other words, this is not John Carter. The studio isn't just throwing their arms up and saying, forget it, we're done. They do seem like they're interested in pursuing it. And I think that they know they've got something with Rooney Mara, too.
Well, one of the things I think was advantageous for the American version is they had more money.
Yeah. Yes.
Because the Swedish films were very much made on this TV movie, TV miniseries budget.
Yeah.
And with the American version, they had money for CGI and all these other things. They could get this really beautiful house in Sweden to do it in.
And for a Led Zeppelin cover. For the theme song.
Oh, goodness gracious. That was just weird.
Was it not like a James Bond intro? I mean, if they're trying not to make us think of Daniel Craig as James Bond, they kind of messed up there. I liked it, but it didn't make me not think of James Bond to have
It was very much a punk rock James Bond theme.
Yeah.
And I tweeted this, and I got followed by Music Box Films.
Yeah, me too. We're both followed by Music Box. I don't know if Yellowbird is out there on Twitter, but yeah, Music Box Films that did the Swedish versions for sure. Yeah, that's right. Okay, now I wanted to say a couple things about Rooney Mara. Now, Rooney Mara is interesting to me. She first kind of emerged on the scene, well, maybe not the first time. The first time I heard of her, she was the girlfriend of the Facebook founder guy in Social Network.
Okay.
And she was just like the sweet little innocent girl, you know, nobody would have ever thought, Lisbeth Salander. And interestingly, her name is Rooney Mara, and I knew those names sounded familiar to me, and I found out later on that it was because...
Her sister.
Well, I don't know, but her names are significant, both of them.
Okay.
The owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers is the Rooney family, and the owner of the New York Giants is the Wellington Mara family, and she's the daughter of a couple that got married from those two families.
Oh.
So she's Rooney Mara.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So she's got money, theoretically, already.
Because I knew her because I had seen her sister in things.
Who's her sister?
Kate Mara.
Oh, okay. Right.
She's more recently in that Kevin Spacey House of Cards mini series.
Okay. All right.
She plays the journalist.
All right. Okay. Well.
Which, if you haven't checked that out, that's really really good stuff.
That's that Netflix original?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's as good as the British version.
Hmm.
Which, that's something else you could do a show about, because there are multiple versions of that.
Okay.
And both are very highly acclaimed, and of course there's a book series as well.
See, I haven't seen that, so I'll have to look into that. Sure, I'm always glad to find out new stuff, for sure, like that. Well, Rooney Mara, she wanted the part, and she went to audition for Fincher, and he just never did really think that she had the grit and that she was mean enough and tough enough. And, you know, so she went and like got some actual piercings done for real, at least one, like, you know, her nose or something for her eyebrow for real. The others were fake. And he kept bringing her back in because he liked her and he thought she was good, but he just was never convinced. And so I was reading somewhere that she had to do like four or five different auditions. And finally she just told him, look, all right, you know, you've seen what I can do. So cast me or let me go, but make up your mind. And he's like, okay, you're in. So that's how she got the part. She had to go through a lot of hurdles to get that part and to prove herself. And I think that she really certainly did that. And I was very pleased.
Yeah, it was another one of those female roles that maybe 100 different big name actresses tried out for. I mean, you had people like Scarlett Johansson, who they decided was too sexy, and Emma Watson.
Yeah,
trying to find, man, that would have been an interesting thing because, of course, Emma Watson has that huge fan base from the Harry Potter films.
Right. Oh, that would have been strange.
That would have been quite weird.
Wow. I can't imagine her with spiky black hair and chain smoking cigarettes. And it definitely would have changed her image.
Yes.
But of course, that's kind of what it did to Rooney Mara. It was, you know, she was the, like I said, she was the little sweetheart girlfriend in Social Network. And nobody expected her to come across the way she does. She seems very, she's kind of fidgety and distracted and stuff. And it gives a really...
I think it would have done for Emma Watson what that Broadway play did for Daniel Radcliffe.
Where he's naked.
With the horses.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I guess the Harry Potter kids are really trying to do everything they can to bust out of that box, aren't they?
Except for the redheaded kid. What was his name? Rupert?
Yeah, Rupert, whatever.
Yeah, there you go.
That's a good point. We can't remember. Yeah. He'll probably end up doing... he may end up robbing liquor stores like the other child actors.
Well, I've seen him in some. I've seen him in like trailers for independent films that I've never seen. But I'm sure some fan of the Harry Potter films is screaming at their iPod right now.
You jerks! He was in this. How could you forget it? You know, one other neat thing I wanted to mention before we close up a little bit is that. I read somewhere that the books were obviously written before the iPhone, and they make the point, and the movies had to deal with this, especially the American movie, had to deal with the fact that some of the things that happen, there's no doubt Elizabeth would have had an iPhone.
Yes.
And she could have done some things with it that would have messed up the plot. You know, she would have had access to information and various things that would have messed up the plot. I can't remember the specifics, but...
Not only would she have had an iPhone, she would have had a jailbroken iPhone.
Right, right. And so they either have to find ways to, like, say, oh, it wouldn't work. Like, they're on an island or they're this, that, and the other that you don't have access to the signal. Or you have to keep them as period pieces set in 2004 or 2005. If you have it after 2007, it really, you know, you have to start making excuses for why her phone doesn't work. So I think they do that with Blomquist, right? He's on that island and his phone doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something else interesting about these books and films. It shows you how much attitudes towards people with alternative lifestyles has changed in the last 10 years. Because they're very able to stigmatize Lisbeth because she's had this lesbian relationship with Miriam Wu.
Mm-hmm.
And she, who is a, not quite a dominatrix, but she appears in bondage shows and
right.
Such that, where I'm kind of reading it and I'm looking like, okay, why is this a big deal?
Yeah, they get and that's the thing. The Swedish men, especially the cops, get all worked up and hot and bothered about it, and are very rude to her. to Miriam Wu and about things like that. And that was kind of shocking to me.
And then I realized I have to think back 10 years and I realized how our own perspectives were. And I realized, oh no, wait, this meshes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, wow, things have changed a lot in 10 years.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know how much of it is the time and how much of it is Sweden versus America, but it is very interesting to watch the movies, to read the books, and to think about, at least, you know, think about how much is this different from how it is now, how much is this is America, how much of this is just another country, even Sweden, which we would have thought. I mean, again, yeah, like we were saying a while ago, I would not have thought that Sweden would have been this, that people in Sweden would have been this prejudiced and this, you know,
conservative.
Yeah, I didn't. And I was really surprised. I mean, but that's, you know, I've studied international relations and everything my whole life. And one thing I've definitely learned, but it still surprises you on specific cases. But one thing I've definitely learned is that every country has multiple dimensions of,
yes,
of attitudes, and you just, when you start to stereotype a country or a people as one thing, you find out that there's just as many in that country that are totally different, you know, and you can't go by that. So I think that's the case here, and it's fascinating to learn that, I think.
Yes.
To learn that the world really is not just black and white, you know, like you were saying a while ago, there really is, and the books reflect that depth, and the movies reflect that depth, which is one of the things that's appealing about them. So.
And that's why, like you said, Sweden is very much a character.
Yeah.
In this book, I went to Disney World not too long ago with my girls, and there is a ride at Epcot that's called Maelstrom.
Hmm.
It's really Norway themed,
mm-hmm,
but you get this idea of Scandinavian life and up there and like, huh, this is interesting, but there's this other stuff I want to see too. But of course it's Disney World, so I'm not going to see, you know, Lizzo sitting on a flaming car. For one thing, it's Norway, but it's very much trolls and Vikings,
right,
and oil rigs.
Yeah, all the stereotypes, right, exactly.
Yes.
You don't get the skinheads and the beating up women and the gang rape and the stuff that the kind of these books explore.
Although, to be fair, in the film, every woman is blonde.
Except Elizabeth.
Except Elizabeth, who's actually a redhead who dyes her hair black.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the last thing I think I was going to mention, and we'll see if there's anything you want to finish up with, is that there's been a graphic novel adaptation that DC did. The first volume came out a few months ago, the first half. It's a 2-volume hardcover. The second volume, finishing up The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it's a 2-volume graphic novel adapting the first book. And it's much more the books than it is the movie, I think. It's got stuff that I'd forgotten because it's not in the movie. The second one just came out, I think, in the last few weeks, and they're okay. I thought it was not bad at all, and I like seeing them doing something a little different like this. I like seeing, you know, because, you know, when Marvel and DC have in the past expanded into literary stuff, it's been Stephen King or Robert Jordan, which is sort of ready-made for comics. So this is kind of different, and I like that.
Yeah, I'm looking at the cover for the first one, which is available. It's the free special edition preview from Comixology, and it's from Vertigo.
Yeah, Vertigo.
Which is interesting. I mean, they're using Vertigo now to do adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to be fair, this is a international sensation.
Right.
I mean, I can only envy these sales figures.
Well, I just like that they're doing a comic adaptation of something that's not a fantasy, horror, sci-fi property so much. It is kind of superheroic, as we talked about, which is ironic since it's Vertigo, the one branch that doesn't do that kind of thing. But Vertigo for those that don't know, Vertigo is DC's line of more, I guess, kind of more mature, a little more, less superhero, more kind of, what would you say? How would you describe Vertigo?
Supernatural.
Yeah, supernatural stuff.
Because, of course, the flagship title for Vertigo for years was Neil Gaiman's Sandman series.
Right, right. So I guess that would be a good calling card for them to get this property would be to say we published Neil Gaiman for years, so why not Stieg Larsson, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it very much has this supernatural kind of alternative feel to it, the Vertigo books.
Yeah, I think that this fits comfortably there, despite its lack of supernatural stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's quirky enough, and Lisbeth is enough of a alternative, like you say, character that. But yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I thought they did a pretty good job with it. It definitely held my interest all the way through, and I've got to go get the second half and finish it pretty soon. I picked the first half up at the library, so I'll go find the second half. But all right. Well, any other thoughts about this whole property in general before we kind of wrap up?
I think it's going to be remembered as a classic.
Yeah.
I honestly think this is going to be a darker, one of those darker classics that's remembered. Kind of on the same lines as something like Maltese Falcon Maltese Falcon and say the Thin Man.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure one of my prejudices lie.
Yeah, well, I hope that we do get the other two American movies just because I'd like, if for nothing else, I'd like for the American audience to continue being reminded of this story and these characters. Because as soon as you stop getting movies, as soon as you stop getting new items based on them, on this property, people will start to forget a little bit, I'm afraid. And so every time a movie comes out, a whole new crop of people discover the books. And, you know, it keeps going a little bit longer. And so please, David Fincher, make the second and third movies and hurry up.
Well, they haven't forgotten Harry Potter yet. That's a plus.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So I guess they had a bigger – I don't know. I guess that means that in 2008 there must not have been a Harry Potter book if Larsson was better selling than J.K. Rowling. That's pretty impressive.
No, there was that was 2007. You're right. Mm-hmm. The last Harry Potter book came out in summer of 2007.
Okay. So, well, it's a different audience, too. I mean, I can't imagine. I'm sure there's some overlap, sure, but yeah.
Me, for instance.
It's what?
Me, for instance.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I like Harry Potter art, too. I like this a lot better, though. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. We'll keep our eye out on the American second and third movies, and maybe someday we'll get that fourth book, and maybe someday justice will be served to Blomqvist's longtime companion. We will see, but okay, so my closing thought would be go out, get the first book, watch the first miniseries part on iTunes if you can, and pick up the Blu-ray or the DVD of the American version. You can't go wrong with any of it. All of it's great. They haven't made a false step yet, so enjoy.
Yeah.
Right.
There you go.
All right. Well, our time is about up, and it's time for the rocket to get on out of here for another week. I would like to thank James for coming aboard today. James, thanks a bunch, man.
No problem.
James can be found on Twitter at MIJDER. That's at MIJDER. He is, of course, the editor-in-chief of Domino Comics, and you can follow Domino Comics on Twitter at Domino COMIX. That's at Domino COMIX. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll see you folks down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.